Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, July 25th. I'm your humble host, PK, back here to thrill you with intellectual pursuits about world events, geopolitics, history, geography. So we have an interesting guest tonight. I'll talk about a little, and she'll be coming on very soon. Again, if you want to call in the show, our number is 888-260-3070. We had a tragedy happen over the weekend in Norway, a country I've been to several times on cruise ships. I love Oslo. I've been along the coast. I call them like one reindeer towns. I've been in the Arctic Circle. I've been to a lot of these places. Very nice, nice people. They all speak English, seems like. My first hunch was, oh, no, is this a false flag attack? So apparently this guy has a manifesto, and he killed all these people. I was surprised it took the police 90 minutes to respond when they have lots of helicopters because of islands and the type of country that it is. I still wonder if he blew up the government buildings. You know, I always had that false flag attack issue, so that is something that came to mind right away. And the guest that I'm going to bring on very soon here, her name is Allison Weir, and she's the director of Americans, If Americans Knew. And it is an organization that is a nonpartisan educational organization of peace, and they provide information and speakers on Israeli-Palestine issues, religious, ethnic, racial, and political things going on over there in the Middle East. And this lady's very brave. In my view, I've seen her picture, and I've seen her speak a little bit, I think, on YouTube. And I'm a fan of hers and her organization, because she's not afraid to inform people about what's going on over in the Middle East and what our tax dollars are buying us, so to speak, hence If Americans Knew. So that is something that we're going to have a lively discussion tonight about Israel, Zionism, the war, many other things. And it's something that I like to talk about because it's a touchy subject, Israel, Zionism, Jewish power. And it's something that I will it's something that I like to talk about, and I'm not afraid to talk about, and it's something that needs to be spoken of.
BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information. Knowledge, bringing humanity closer to truth.
Hello there, everybody. This is PK. I'm back. We had some technical problems. I hope I'm not too choppy, my voice. A little trouble with Comcast, internet gremlins, this and that. I don't know. Maybe it's tonight's topic. Certain people don't want this sort of thing to continue. I hope my guest Allison is out there. Allison, are you out there?
Yes, I am. I can hear you okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. It's good to hear your voice, and welcome to Third Stream View.
Thank you.
Would you like some tea or coffee?
Yeah, how about a cup of tea? Sounds great.
Sorry, it's self-service. But I'd like to thank you again for coming on. And I was skimming your website earlier of Americans New, and I was just looking at the wealth of information you have here. And I must tell you that yours is one of the most thorough of a lot of things that I've studied and I've looked into. And I appreciate all this stuff that you put together on here. I think it's very, very valuable. It's what I like to call objective, intellectual, scholarly research.
Thank you. Well, that's certainly what we strive to do. You know, my basic philosophy is we really need to get the facts on lots of issues, especially on this one. So, with our website, we're trying to get as many of those facts together as clearly and understandably with both citations and everything as we can do. So I'm glad to think we're getting close to that goal anyway.
I think you're very close, and I commend you for what you do, and I think you're quite brave to do this because I know that I see on here that you've received death threats, as have other organizations who talk about these things here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we're supposed to have free speech and a free press. I know that global Zionism doesn't like this sort of stuff, nor our conversation. And let me say in advance that, and I just say this very calmly, that any discussion, generally speaking, any discussion, objective intellectual discussion, hate-free, that involves criticism or critiquing or expose on Israel, Zionism, and Jewish power, you're automatically labeled anti-Semitic, pretty much. So I just throw that out there up front as a given. So, you know, when those forces accuse anyone of that, well, we expected it. What took you so long? And then, you know, next topic.
That's how I look at it. You know, any time that people give information about Israel that's negative and information, let's look at it. Information on any country in the world will have negative facts. And you're not usually called, you know, anti-French if you give some of the facts about France that are may not be something that the Chamber of Commerce wants to put out there. But when you do that about Israel, then, of course, you're instantly called anti-Semitic, even if you're talking about a nation state, actions by a government, not by a religion. That's a tactic that's used. The intention clearly is either to prevent people from speaking out because nobody likes to be called names, or to try to discredit the person rather than addressing the information, which is almost always accurate. Especially when the information is accurate, that they then will resort to this kind of epithet rather than dealing with the content. They'll just try to undermine the effectiveness of people learning these facts.
Oh, true. They always do that. You know, I just expect it. And it seems like you can criticize any other group, or any other tribe, any group. And I say criticize. I'm not equating that with hatred, which like a lot of people would like to do to try to discredit it. But any criticism, again, of Israel, you can't criticize Israel. And there's this fear about doing it. Well, look what you're up against, Allison. You know who the neoconservatives are, I'm sure. You know that whole concept of neoconservatism. That is all across talk radio, Fox News, and even the other networks. So you have all these, you know, sheeple who have been indoctrinated into there's so much Christian Zionism also going on. So we're up against all that they think, oh, Israel has to be protected. It's, you know, it's biblical.
That's been an intentional part of Zionism, of creating the state on land that was originally multicultural land. Palestine was about 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, a little under 5% Jewish. Then there was an ideological group located in Europe that decided that they needed and they wanted a Jewish state somewhere in the world. It was, at the beginning, especially a very secular movement. They started to colonize Palestine, despite the fact that it was fully inhabited, with an ideology and a movement that would consist of pushing out 95% of the people that were there.
Right.
And one of the ways that they tried to sell this program that took a number of years. At first, it was very small, quite fringe, and extremely fanatic for a number of decades. But one of the ways they tried to sell it was through using religion, and both the Jewish religion. That's why they ended up choosing Palestine. They had considered Uganda. They considered Argentina. But, you know, by choosing Palestine for the place to colonized, then they could try to evoke biblical connections both from Jews and from Christians. Even though both parties, especially at the beginning, were especially opposed to the concept because it was considered heretical, especially by the religious population, Jewish population in Europe and in Palestine itself, all opposed this ideology as being heretical and very much against God's will. But, you know, using religion can help to sell things, and that's what they tried to do and eventually succeeded in doing.
Yes. Well, they were the, also I like to say, they're especially post-World War One, they were the Rothschild-backed Zionists. And Zionism is overwhelming, and I would also say that most of the world Jewry population, I would say the majority, is either purely secular and or agnostic and or atheistic. And here's the link I made that I just love, that come 1948, you have the Zionists shouting, "God gave us this land," shouted the atheist Zionist Jews, because Israel was founded primarily by white European or Russian or Eastern European socialist, communist, atheist, Zionist Jews, as I understand it. So God gave us this land, shouted the atheist Jews. Well, how, if you're an atheist, how did God give you the land? If your whole movement is pretty much atheistic, as or, you know, communism, how does God give you the land? Have you ever looked at it that way?
Yeah, it's very contradictory because, as you say, many of the leaders, the initial leaders, many of the leaders today, many of the leaders for the last, you know, 100 years that really have been pushing this ideology have not been observant. They've been
true,
you know, not religious at all, and that yet they made use of this, you know, claiming that God gave the land to someone, even though they will admit and acknowledge that they don't themselves believe in God. So there's, you know, a strange contradiction that's going on there.
It's
and
actually laughable.
Overall, it's a very strange situation and sort of difficult sometimes to discuss because Israel goes back and forth in the way it portrays itself as being just a normal nation state. That's how they'll try to portray the country at times. But then they will use these sort of religious terms. At other times, they'll use tribal terms. The idea is Israel was to be and is self-proclaimed the Jewish state.
Right.
You know, does that mean it's a religious state? What does it mean by Jew? And it's not a religious definition. When somebody, a Jewish American, say, decides that they want to go to Israel and become an Israeli citizen and get the financial perks that that gives them, they don't sort of have to say, well, I believe in God, I attend a synagogue, here's how I prove that I'm a Jew in religious terms. They just show that they have heritage that's, you know, from a mother or grandmother. That's
right.
How they prove it in a tribalistic kind of way, an ethnic kind of way, not a religious kind of way. So it's not, in that definition, it's not a religion at all. It's a tribe, a sort of a form of ethnocentrism.
It's very tribal, and a lot of them hide behind the Jewish religion as a shield. And most of these today's Jews, especially in Israel, they're not even Semitic. They're not even Semites. The real Semites are the Arabs. Most of the Israelis, you know, they came from today's Israelis in the last 60 years or so. Again, they came from Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia. And I've since 9/11, when, you know, there's this demonization of Islam, which I'm very much opposed to. Yes, there are radical elements of Islam, but again, it's an exact rejection or anger towards U.S. foreign policy that stays in place no matter who's in power. That's why they're pissed off with, you know, the U.S. federal government. I like to be specific. I don't like to say we or America. I like to say the federal government of Washington, D.C. You have them propping up Israel ever since 1948. You have them installing the Shah in power 58 years ago next month. The CIA overthrew, you know the story, I'm sure. And then you have the feds, the federal government, propping up Saddam, propping up, you know, Saudi, Egypt, all these countries, and the CIA heavily involved. That's why these people are angry. You know, it's come to a head, and they don't like it, and we wouldn't like it either. So that's how I see it. And I'm also fond of quoting myself on this. No one's yet to disprove me on this, that America had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948 when Israel was violently imposed on Palestine. Am I right?
That's correct. I've just been reading quite a bit of the history that around 1948, 1947, decades before that, and the State Department and the Pentagon consistently were saying that. They were consistently saying that supporting Zionism would damage U.S. interests in the area, that the U.S. had had and needed very good relations with the Arab population and the Arab countries at that time, that this was very important to U.S. needs, and also that it was in line with U.S. principles of self-determination that had been espoused by Woodrow Wilson. So it's just astounding. I've been reading all of these papers by diplomats in the 40s, 30s, 20s, consistently saying that Zionism is a very counter kind of ideology to American principles, that it would be exploiting the U.S. to do something that would be profoundly wrong, and that it would damage Americans enormously. And their predictions were entirely correct, as we're seeing today. But they were overruled by presidents who realized that Zionists had a very strong lobby, even in those days, beginning early on, a very strong lobby in the United States that could make a major difference in whether or not they would be reelected to office. So consistently, we see politicians from both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats equally, deciding that they would make important decisions regarding the Middle East and regarding U.S. national interests, the safety of Americans, would be subservient to their desire to be reelected. And instead of taking the advice that was being given by the State Department and by the Pentagon, they would instead go with their domestic advisors on what would help them get elected, and so they consistently take and support the Zionist Israeli stand.
That's true. Therefore, President Truman, against the advice of George Marshall and some of his other advisors, went ahead and recognized Israel against their advice. Plus, I believe he had something like $2 million in campaign donations from wealthy Jewish donors and or Zionist U.S. donors. So this greatly influenced that also. Now, if we look back to when Theodore Herzl, you know who this is, right?
Yeah.
You know this name? The founder of modern-day Israel, 1860 to 1904, when he convened his conference in Switzerland in 1897, I believe it was, with powerful Zionists, it was then that they wanted to set up the State of Israel. Now, he was an atheist Hungarian, white Hungarian Jew, an atheist. By the way, I myself am an atheist. I'm a non-militant atheist. Catholics make the best atheists. So I'm a non-militant atheist. So that gives me some cred, I believe, to deal with the topic we're on and all the atheism that permeates itself through it. But Theodore Herzl wanted to set up the state of Israel. But as far as I know, except for some purges in Russia in the 19th century, mid, maybe, and late 19th century, as bad as those purges were, I do not know of rampant anti-Semitism through Europe that I've heard of, besides the Dreyfus Affair, and that was small potatoes. But I don't know of, you know, so for this push for a Jewish state, to me, it was out of line. So you had it coming out of, as you know, the 1917 Balfour Declaration, where Britain promised Palestine to the Zionists. Well, Britain had no more right to give Palestine to the Zionists or to the Jews than would the U.S. say to give Argentina to Japan.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. One thing that's maybe important to do if for any listeners that haven't really studied this before, and that's the way I was about 11 years ago, just to define the word Zionist, it just occurred to me, because I know I never used to really, I'm sure I had no idea what that word even meant, and I might have thought it meant it was a synonym for Jew, which it's not. A Zionist is an adherent of a political ideology. We're talking about political Zionism,
right,
in which that they wish to have an exclusively or certainly a preferentially Jewish state somewhere in the world, and the place that they chose for that was Palestine. So when we're talking about Zionists, we're talking about a specific person with a specific ideology. Most of them, especially at the beginning, were Jewish Zionists. There are also now something called Christian Zionism, which is a bizarre phenomenon. But that's what we're talking about. We're not sort of saying that this is all Jews. It's not. There was an effort to make this movement appear to be supported by Jews around the world that...
Right.
Continues today. It's been opposed, sadly, it's captured much of the Jewish population, but there's been numerous, just large numbers of exceptions from the very beginning. Some of the major opponents of this ideology, as I said, originally were sometimes religious Jews. Then they've also been a great many people that were opposed to it politically, because they felt it was wrong. They felt that it didn't represent their belief in what it meant to be a Jew, either religiously or in a secular manner. And some of the people that opposed it, for example, in the 1940s at the United Nations, were anti-Zionist Jews who were opposing it, people like Rabbi Elmer Berger, Alfred Lilienthal. So it's important for people to recognize what these definitions mean and what they don't mean.
Right.
In terms of the Balfour Declaration in 1917, what's very interesting with that, and again, I've just been reading about that section quite a bit more lately, is that this was a trade-off that was being pushed by Zionists in Britain, who were pushing for Britain to support their push for a Jewish state in Palestine, by saying what they were telling the British government at that time, and this was being negotiated, you know, for a number of years while Britain was in what was called the Great War in 1916 in particular, when they were in desperate circumstances and very fearful of losing that war, which it looked like they were going to lose. So they were very vulnerable to promises that were being made by the Zionists in 1916 and before, that if Britain would promise to help them have a, quote, Jewish home in Palestine, if Britain won the war, which meant that they would then defeat the Ottomans and have some power over Palestine, that if they would make the Zionists that promise, the Zionists would help them win that war, because they would use their Zionists in the United States, who are very influential, people like Louis Brandeis, who is a Supreme Court justice, that they would use Zionists in the U.S. to push the U.S. to enter the Great War on the side of England. This is a very significant factor. This is something I had never learned studying American history, either in high school or in college.
Nor I.
A factor of some significance in why the U.S. joined a war that made no sense, that was a massively tragic war that should not have happened, that Americans had absolutely nothing to do with. We weren't part of those entangling alliances that got everybody else into the war. the American population had voted for Woodrow Wilson with his promise that he, quote, kept us out of the war and would continue to keep us out of what we now call World War One. And yet, even though he had been elected with that mandate to keep Americans out of the war, he then, interestingly, enters the war in 1917, thereby showing that the Zionist promise to Britain had been upheld, and that later, Lloyd George, who had been Prime Minister of Britain, years later, in I think speaking before the British Parliament, said the Zionists made us a promise, and they kept their promise. So again, I'm not saying, I don't know whether this was the decisive factor in the U.S. entry into the war, as Zionists claim that it was, and as Lloyd George and even Winston Churchill later sort of suggest that it was, or whether maybe it was a more minor factor. But it was some sort of factor, and I think as Americans, we should know that. I don't think that should be hidden from us.
It was a major factor, Allison. I've learned this about 6 years ago. Can I elaborate on that a little bit more for you?
Sure.
First of all, in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, Wilson was one of our worst presidents ever. And then FDR did some of the same things. You know, peace, you know, he's running for peace. Well, behind the scenes, he's scheming to get us involved in war. For all intents and purposes, Germany was the victor in Europe in 1916. And Germany only did what it did because Russia and France mobilized against Germany, so they struck first. The U.S. was totally against being involved in the wars. Here's something crucial I didn't know, that the British cut the telegraph lines from Europe to the U.S. during the war, or at the start of the war, but they did not cut the telegraph lines from Britain to the U.S. So the U.S. only got British propaganda that whole period. And to this day, I happen to be very pro-British, very anti-Churchill for many reasons. World War One is part of them. But I can also get into Hitler a little bit about this. So Palestine was under since Germany was in league with allied with Turkey. Well, Turkey controlled a large section of the Middle East, including Palestine. And T. E. Lawrence, one of my biggest heroes, was helping the Arabs liberate themselves from Turkish rule. But he told them, at least until the Allies stabbed Lawrence in the back, that they weren't going to exchange Turkish rulers for European rulers. And that, of course, that's what's happened. And prior to the Balfour Declaration, which was 1917, in 1916, you had the Sykes-Picot Treaty between British and French civil servants who were planning on how to divide up the spoils of the Middle East after World War One. Now, I don't know if you knew that. So what happens? When they realize that Germany was winning, the Zionists and the Zionist German Jewish bankers got in touch with the British and said, you know, you can still win this war. We'll help you. We'll bring America over on your side with our control and influence in the American press and our power, political power in America. We'll bring the U.S. into the war on your side, but you've got to give us Palestine. So that's what happened. And here I'd like to say thank goodness for objective, intellectual, scholarly revisionism, because these very important things have been left out of our history. And, you know, history's written by the victors. So this is what happened. So, okay, later on, when you've got Hitler getting down on the Jews and saying things like the Jews stabbed Germany in the back, well, to be more specific, he was referring to the bankers, the Zionist bankers who stabbed Germany in the back and sold Germany out. That's what he was referring to. And I'll even take it to today. The mess we're in today is because a lot of these bankers, the international bankers and the Rothschilds and the globalists, they're Jewish, Zionist Jewish bankers, Bernanke, Greenspan. So, you know, who would have thought? I see the whole spectrum as, once again, we're involved with a problem with global bankers, and global Zionism plays a big role. You've got the Rockefeller wing in league with the Zionist, international Zionist Rothschild wing. That's how I see it. So, yes, your details about World War One, we're very good. I'm glad you know about that. Most people don't.
Well, there's a lot there. And again, I don't, you know, I like to personally, in my approach, I just try to find as many of these facts as I can. And then eventually you get enough facts. It's like a dot to dot, like one of those
right.
things that you, you know, you get enough dots and you start to try to connect what kind of picture it shows you. And it does show you a very different picture than most of us grew up being taught.
Well, it fills in a lot, you know, because why did country A attack country B? There's got to be other reasons more than just what we're being told.
That's right. You see a lot of factors. I know I had, at one point, I'd learned about Charles Lindbergh and the America First Committee, and it appeared to me very sad that it seemed that it was anti-Semitic movement and Charles Lindbergh was anti-Semitic. And,
that's
you know,
how he
I
was
just heard that
smeared.
Many decades ago. Then, you know, independently, I just got curious about Palestine for a whole different reason, started looking into more and more of the history of that, in addition to going over and seeing it firsthand for myself on a number of independent trips. But then I wanted to really study the history of it, and the more I studied it, I'd read all these books. And then I, you know, start seeing all these references to the Balfour Declaration, and then little footnotes about why it had been past, why they had made this, quote, you know, somewhat questionable promise to the Zionists. And it was a very conditional promise. It's not really the way Zionists portray it completely, but it opened the door a bit for them to push it open much wider later.
Oh, yeah.
And you see all these references to promises to get the U.S. to enter World War I by using Zionist pressure in the United States to do that. And then it strikes you, well, that's interesting, because that's what somebody like Charles Lindbergh was stating prior to World War II, that some, you know, could seem like an anti-Semitic, bigoted comment. And then you realize, well, wait, that's the promise the Zionists themselves were saying they had made and succeeded in making in World War I. So it gives you a whole different look at
well, he was
who Charles
scared.
Lindbergh was. And what America First was about. And you discovered that the America First Committee was before both of those wars. The mass of Americans did not want to join wars. We really don't want to go over and fight lots of wars around the world.
True.
Wars are horrible things. You know, I grew up in a military family. My father was a military officer. He had fought in World War II. He was not fond of wars. Anybody that has fought in a war realized they are terrible, terrible occurrences, that most often the best thing to do is to avoid them.
Yeah, that's
and
for sure.
And in many cases, they quite likely could have and should have been avoided. And instead, you know, usually, in many cases, the public is sold what is usually the fiction that we will end the killing by having a war. You know, there's some sort of bad despotic regime, and we'll go in and end that despotism and that killing by having a war. And, of course, when you look at history, you find that, no, what actually happened is many, many more people were killed on all sides by the war. So it's not that I'm saying it might be that there are times that you need war. There certainly are times that if my children or my grandchildren were at risk and I needed to use violence to save them, I would do so. So it's not that I'm saying violence, you know, that I'm convinced violence must never be used or should never have been used. I'm not saying that. But historically, you find that most often it probably should not have been used. Most often it resulted in more tragedy, not less tragedy.
Very true.
And here you find an American population consistently with the common sense to realize that, to realize, wait, in 1914, 15, 16, not wanting to go and join this carnage that was going on in Europe that made no sense. Trench warfare where people were being destroyed, and if they weren't being killed, they were returning home maimed. You know, the vast majority of the American public didn't want to join that. Wilson, as you say, finally, for interesting and, you know, mixed reasons, I feel, I don't think Zionism was the only reason. I think it could have been the major factor, but, you know, suddenly suddenly the U.S. is joining that war, and you have the Alien and Sedition Act being enacted so that hundreds and hundreds of Americans around the country are rounded up and put in prison for even just talking against the war.
You know, Lincoln did that, too.
Back in those days.
Did you know that Lincoln did that, too?
I have read that. I haven't looked into that as much. You know,
hundreds of newspaper editors or publishers were put in jail, and many anti-war people were threatened. So in my view, step back, the worst presidents I know in American history, the worst, were Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, LBJ, and then Bush 2, and now Obama, in my view. And look what a war footage we're on. And look, hasn't Hillary become quite the hawk?
Very much so. You know, I think those of us that have followed that don't find that a surprise, even though it's sad. And those of us that have been following this knew that Obama, even though similarly to Wilson, Obama was supposed to be the candidate of change. Compared to McCain, he was people that thought that by voting for Barack Obama, we would end the war sooner, we would withdraw troops. I think a great many people felt that we would close down Guantanamo. And yet, of course, none of that has happened. And those of us who've been following this issue realize that it's because there's a very powerful lobby in this country called the Israel Lobby. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is Washington, D.C. works with lobbies. There are many lobbies that are highly influential in Washington. And one of the most influential and one of the ones that's least opposed over the decades has been the lobby for Israel. So it's not surprising that it would largely call the shots, and that's what it does.
The Israeli lobby.
That's right.
And, of course, their main battering ram is AIPAC, which I mentioned to you before. I'll redefine AIPAC for you, is the American-Israeli Parasites Against the Constitution. Thank you very much. Now, that's the battering ram, and they're heavily funded, and, you know, they're very powerful. When I've had this discussion or tried to touch on this with my friends who are conservatives, Republicans, they're very sort of fearful, and they're very skittish about talking about Israel. And why is that? Well, you have Reverend Hagee especially and Pat Robertson, you know, imploring their flocks to support Israel. And these Christian Zionist ministers who are doing all this crap, they're the ones that have really sold the American public on this. But where was this mentality before, say, 1948? Where was this fear of this, I think it's BS about Muslims want to put Sharia law here or they want to take over the world. I think it's nonsensical. Maybe some of the radicals do, and they're held up as what, the majority? That's like saying all Italians are gangsters because of Al Capone and a few other criminals.
Yeah, it's just part of the strategy. Jerry Falwell, you know, the founder or sort of the head of the quote,
the late Jerry Falwell, yes, he was another one.
Was bought a jet plane by Israel. So what you have in this country, and it started back at the turn of the 1900s largely, for many, many years was a really tiny little group that did not represent the majority of American Jews at all. But it was a tiny, very, very focused group and often well-financed group, especially compared to, you know, especially when you have nobody opposing you.
Sure.
Extremely well financed, pushing an ideology that they realized they could make use of what had been originally a very fringe theology in Christianity, dispensationalism. It was it's a theology that's been around for before the political Zionist movement, but it was always a very minor one. It was never a major one. But by latching onto that, by funding preachers that either believed it already or were very happy to preach that when they got a jet plane to do it and a lot of money to do it with, they could make what was a minor theology into one that has grown significantly by coincidence during the time that Israel has been a state and just before that, beginning in about the early 1940s. it's really astounding how intentional this has been, and sadly how successful it has been. There are many fundamentalist Christian ministers who actually oppose that theology.
Thank goodness.
That are fundamentalist, not just, you know, the mainstream churches, almost all of them oppose it. Almost all of them has argued against this theologically. You know, it's very easy to do if you look at the whole of the Bible, not just a few verses, especially if you look at the New Testament, which one would think Christians would cite, but mostly the, you know, these Christian Zionists, and Zionists as they call themselves and others call them,
maybe so with the Old Testament. Testament.
They don't really look at the teachings of Jesus that one would think would be important to them. They sort of ignore all of those.
Well, they don't want to offend their Zionist masters.
Theologically, but, pardon?
They don't want to offend their Zionist masters. It's always the Old Testament. And since I'm an atheist, I can say, since I don't read fiction, to me it's a Hebrew fairy tale, and the Jews who wrote the Bible enshrined themselves as the chosen people. So that mentality has carried on. Something I learned, and I am a partial to this view, that the Jews, of course, the Jews of Israel today are not the Jews of the Bible, nor are most Jews in the world, because after 70 AD, you know, when there was the diaspora after the Romans trashed the temple, are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe you know where I'm going with this. This is what I've learned. So there was the great diaspora, Jews, wandering Jews, this and that. So it all they all went their way. It took the 12 tribes. Well, comes about 750 AD in an area of northeast Turkey, southwest Russia, called Khazar, the Khazarian area. The king of the Khazars was sort of a nomadic tribe, or the Asiatic tribe, who settled in this area. They were warrior-like. They were getting pressure on the eastern side from Islam and from the western side from Christianity. So the king chose a religion. He chose Judaism for his kingdom. So by decree, all these pretty much white folks became Jewish about 750 AD, and they're not Semites. That is the legacy. Then, you know, they settled in Palestine later, in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and Russia. So this is this legacy. And what you also have today is a lot of Jews. Their legacy is the Talmud. I don't know how much you know about the Talmud. It's the Jewish Book of Law. It's about as old as the Bible is, but it's very racist. It's very racist. Well, it's very anti-Gentile. It's shocking to read the things that it says.
Mm-hmm. It's 25 volumes, so I haven't read it all. But what I have read, first to get back to the Khazars, or however you say it.
Right, Khazars.
Did have this major conversion. That's been written about a fair number of places. Arthur Koestler has a book about it called The 13 Tribes.
You know, I know about it. I haven't read it, but I know
about
it.
Before that time, other people have written about it since that time.
Right.
You know, I've talked to a geneticist who says it does, you know, genetics also supports the history of that. One thing, though, just to make clear, is that this largely is so European Jews appear to have almost no ancestry, probably no ancestry in most cases, that goes back to the Middle East. You know, so the so-called return is just not a return. They have no ancestry that does go back there. Now, the Sephardic Jews that are from the Middle East and North Africa, that's a different group. So that group may indeed have ancestry in the Middle East.
Correct.
As do the Palestinian Christians and Muslims. So if we're looking at the, quote, ancient Israelite, you can find their descendants among some of the Jewish inhabitants of Israel, but also among the Christian and Muslim inhabitants of Israel, who also have ancestry that dates back to the Canaanites and other groups back in ancient Palestine.
True.
Whereas the
Ashkenazi,
the European Jews, who were largely Zionists in the early days, now Israel itself is about half and half. So half the population is European, half of it is from the Middle East and Northern Africa, and of course there's a certain amount of intermarried, so it's a little bit mixed there. But it's an interesting thing to look at. But in terms of the Talmud, which is what the religious part of the Jewish population, the people that are especially most religious in that live in Israel now, quite often, in fact, most often, what they most study, according to an excellent book by Israel Shahak, who was an Israeli professor.
I'm a fan.
They study almost exclusively the Talmud, not the Torah, which
right.
is Christians call the Old Testament, part
Correct.
Of the Testament, not the whole Old Testament. But they largely study the Talmud, which is 25 volumes. So I'm not going to, you know, I'm not by any means an expert in the Talmud.
Neither
but
am I.
I have read books by people that I believe are, that have certainly researched it, and that are Jewish scholars in this. And they have, I would say, one of the important books for everybody to read that wants to understand Israel today needs to read two books by an author named Israel Shahak. His last name is Shahak. He was a Holocaust survivor, a Jewish survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, who went to Israel, saw what Israel was doing, was horrified and very opposed to it, and wrote quite a bit in terms of being critical of the Israeli government and what Israel was doing. So one of his books is called Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel. Very, very important reading. And another book is called Jewish History, Jewish Religion. Both of them are very valuable books. They're not long books. They're, you know, some of the books you read on this topic are very thick and require quite an investment in time. These don't. They're very interesting books. He has the citations where his information comes from, and he does have a number of quotes from the Talmud that are being studied in Israel today. They're not just obscure quotes from, you know, religious scriptures that nobody pays any attention to. These are still being taught by a certain portion of the Israeli public today, and therefore are very significant for people to know. They don't represent the majority of Israelis, because as you point out, the majority are not very religious.
Right.
But there's a minority that is fanatic, is overrepresented in the West Bank, and they are being taught the types of religious statements that say that it is permissible to kill non-Jewish babies. This is being taught. It has been a best-selling book among Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and it's important for people to know those facts. And those are more of the facts that usually are covered up by, you know, by the typical U.S. media coverage of the issue.
Well, speaking of institutionalized racism, that there it is. In fact, when that great religious revolutionary Martin Luther, who spoke Hebrew, first peered into the Talmud in the 16th century, he was shocked by some of the things he read, including that Jesus Christ is in hell languishing in a vat of excrement and his mother is a whore. There's a lot of stuff like that in the Talmud. I haven't read the Talmud. I've read some shocking excerpts from it, and some Jewish authors even put those out there. There's another Jewish author, an anti-Zionist author named Shlomo Sand, I think, and his book is, I think, The Invention of the Jewish People. So I forgot to mention earlier that after 9/11, all this demonization and ganging up on the Muslims and Islam, I went in the other direction. I chose to study the other tribe, their biblical so-called cousins, the Jews. And these are the things I've been learning historically. And a lot of it, I really don't like what I'm reading about. And I'm not talking about stereotypical things about blood libel or who killed Christ. I don't even care. But this Talmud stuff is where a lot of this comes from. And as I speak, I've got one of my biggest heroes above me and behind me in my office, Ludwig von Mises, who was Jewish, one of the architects of the Austrian School of Economics. And behind me, I have Ayn Rand, Alice Rosenbaum, who was Jewish. So for me, I can easily deflect, you know, the old anti-Semitism accusations, because I never advocate anything harm or genocide or into any people losing their rights or their human rights. But damn it, I'm going to criticize. I'm going to draw a line in the sand and say, yeah, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. And I hate to see our tax dollars propping up what I consider to be the apartheid terrorist state of Israel with its endless supply of American foreign aid, and even worse, its endless supply of American, of free American-made murder weapons.
It's a massive amount of money. Yes, it's more than we give to any other country on the planet. It's and it costs us even more than we give to Israel. So currently, we give Israel about $8.2 million per day. This is to just one of the tiniest countries. It's about the size of Vermont or Rhode Island. So it's getting over $8 million per day of our tax money. And
right.
it has additional perks because it gets us all in the lump sum right at the beginning of the year. Since we're operating at a deficit, that means we borrow the money, immediately transfer it to Israel's bank account, and from that point on, we pay interest on this money. Well, Israel, being, you know, the beneficiary.
And they always want more.
Makes interest on the money. So it costs us, one analyst put it at $15 million per day. One man, a very significant economist who was investigating the situation for the Army War College, looked into what our support of Israel had cost the American economy over the past over 60 years, both in direct aid to Israel, the additional costs because of this interest that we're paying on our own money, additional costs because we give them all sorts of special loan agreements that they never repay. They're always forgiven. We give them free weaponry or, you know, heavily subsidized weaponry where we give them something, and then we give them the money, then they allegedly buy our equipment using our own money for it. And then they say, oh, well, since we bought your equipment, you now have to buy our equipment. So then we buy their equipment. But they don't give us the money to buy their equipment the way we just did. So you add
True.
Up all of that, you add up all the tax deductions that pro-Israel individuals get to make when they give millions of dollars to Israel, and they write this off of U.S. taxes. So that's more money lost to the economy. Then you have some boycotts against the United States for many years because of our support for Israel. So that costs us still more money. Then you look at the loss of the cost of the oil embargo against the United States that was done because of Kissinger's support for Israel. So this economist, Thomas Stouffer, looked into the total amount that this has cost the American taxpayer for the past 60 years and came to $3 trillion. $3 trillion for a population that right now at its largest is about 7 million people. Most of that time it was only 3 or 4 million people. It's just an absurd, astounding situation that most people know nothing about, and I was among that group up until 10 years ago.
Allison, why don't we convert and go live there and get in on the goodies?
Yeah, I know. It's if we were Jewish Americans and we chose to go and live in one of these settlements, we would get a free or heavily subsidized house. Our children would go to college for free. We would get free health care. It's a great deal. You know, we would get much more out of our tax money by living there than we do here. Anyway, it would be interesting to look at.
Oh, it's just what a racket. And also, though, the writing's on the wall. There's a lot of Israelis seeking a dual passport now because they see that the future doesn't look too promising. They're just being outnumbered population-wise. Israel's, and I love seeing Israel's back up against the wall these days. It's really worried about it being boycotted. It hates the flotillas. It's like a rabid dog. I'm more afraid of Israel's power than in a nuclear Iran, because Israel has over 200 nukes, and they're pointed. They can hit Russia, China, Britain, Italy. They've got a horrific system called their Samson option, like Samson, the biblical character. So the atheist Jews can have their Samson option, which if Israel's going to go down, if it looks like they're going to go down, they're going to take the rest of the world or whoever they can with them. I don't know if you heard about the Samson option.
I have. It's one of the things that they try to, you know, it's sort of, again, there are all these strange inconsistencies where, you know, they will they have never admitted that they have nuclear weapons, but they threaten people with them all the time.
It's sort
of like when Helen Thomas tried to ask President Obama about, well, what other country in the Middle East has nuclear weapons? You know, Iran doesn't. So she was saying, are there any countries that have them? And, of course, everybody in that press room knew that Israel does. The president knew it. Every other journalist in that room knew it. But no one would speak of it except Helen Thomas. So Israel has these nuclear weapons. It's had them for a long time. It doesn't acknowledge it, and yet it threatens everybody with nuclear weapons, including the whole world. We're supposed to be afraid that they might be fanatic enough to take the whole world down with them if we actually try to do something about their human rights abuses against Palestinians, against lots of other people in that region.
I don't think
they would. You know, this is just a way of trying to blackmail people into going along with their system.
It's very scary.
But they did. They actually came close. They're close to using them. It looks like in 1973, where they were losing that war. You know, again, this is another one of the myths that Israel's military is brilliant and nobody else is as good as they are. Israel and Syria were defeating them in 1973. It was only because of the largest airlift in U.S. history, where we gave Israel massive U.S. weaponry, that they didn't lose that war. Because they were losing it, Moshe Dayan almost had a nervous breakdown, and he was going to use nuclear weapons against his neighbors.
What a legacy that had caused. Allison, I've got a question for you here. I wish I knew this sooner. I don't know how pressed you are for time, but I have an extra time slot available after this where my normal cutoff would be about now. Are you able to stick around any longer?
Well, I'm actually working on an article that I've been trying to get out for a few weeks now.
Okay.
So I don't know if this would be a good time. It might be better to do it another time.
Okay, great, because I'd like to have you back again. And I'd like to leave you with this thought also that as far as Israel goes, and this is sort of my irrefutable logic, is that I challenge anybody, and you can use this, I challenge anybody to show me where it says that the American taxpayer is supposed to fund Israel indefinitely. And Israel is not our 51st state. So please show me in the U.S. Constitution where the U.S. taxpayer is supposed to endlessly fund Israel. You know, and that they can't really wiggle out of that too much. That is something I like to use.
That's right. And it's good to go back to George Washington, who warned against having any kind of passionate attachment to any foreign country over any other foreign country. He, you know, it was in his farewell address, and people need to read that again. It was a very fair warning and a very accurate one. So.
That's true, Allison, but you don't expect most Americans to know anything about history, do you?
Well, some of us are learning it, and I'm hoping more and more of us are going to learn some of this.
Well, I'm not referring to you, my dear, because you've done your homework well. I hope you like where I'm coming from. I hope you think I kept up with you pretty well.
Well, thanks. I like that you're also looking into this and speaking out and trying to be as fair. And we all just want a safer, better world where children grow up and they're safe and happy and they don't kill each other. So let's hope we can get there.
I made a note. This is something else that you might look into with your organization. When I was skimming it, I saw, I think I mentioned different people in the U.S., U.S. Jews who have served in Israel's military and whatnot. You might look into this. I thought that if an American citizen serves in a foreign military, you know, even an ally, a friendly ally, that you lose your U.S. citizenship. I thought that that was... I thought that's what happens if you do that. So that could be some serious. If you find out further about that, that could be some serious.
Yeah, I actually was just reading about that. That used to be the case. It was eventually overruled on behalf of somebody who had done that.
Was it Jewish?
Against the law, appeals courts, and the Supreme Court found against it year after year, and finally, I believe it was the Abe Fortas court that changed U.S. law.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm glad I thought of it. So now, is your organization headquartered in Washington?
No, not right now. Although I have two organizations. One is It's Americans New, which is headquartered in California, The other, I've just become president of a much older organization called the Council for the National Interest, and that's located in Washington, D.C.
So do you have many employees in your groups?
Sadly, not very many. We're not, you know, we don't have anywhere near the funding of our adversaries.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I applaud your efforts. I hope you'll keep it up, and I'd like to have you come back again soon because we've got more to talk about, but I sure enjoyed chatting with you, and your knowledge of history is very good, and I'm glad that you've looked into this stuff and have had the strength and the bravery to do it, and I find you to be a very pleasant person. I don't find any, you know, evil hatred in you at all. You're talking about history and objective facts, and if it steps on some people's toes, well, that's just how it is, because why should we lie about, if we're in the search for truth and peace and a better world for us and our children in the future, then I believe that you and I are both going down the correct path.
I think so. I hope so. Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you so much. I'm going to say goodbye now. Thanks again, Allison Weir from If Americans Knew. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to sign off here again. This is your host, PK. Be back here again next week, same time, same place, bbsradio.com, 855 Pacific, 1055 Central, 1155 Eastern. Thanks again for joining us. I'll talk to you next week. Good night, everyone.